Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and I am pretty darn excited about tonight. By the way, I'm outside. I know you can't really see me now, those of you on YouTube. You can sort of see me. I go in and out. They were saying earlier I look like one of these people that are being interviewed that want to stay anonymous, but it has to do with backlighting. But I'm out actually in my front yard. There's actually a turkey right there walking around right in front of me here. I'm in the front yard today. I went in my studio about an hour ago and it was blistering hot, no ventilation, no air conditioning. So I said, the heck with it. I found I did have a 200-foot Ethernet cable and here I am down at the waterfront. I'm pretty happy about that. It's pretty nice. So I got my Hawaiian type shirt on and we have a wonderful show. Who we have tonight? We have the son of J. Allen Hynek and Paul Hynek. He will be on. And we have Don Schmidt. And they kind of like to sort of tease each other a bit. So I think we're going to have a couple of laughs tonight as well. We're going to talk about the great J. Allen Hynek. And also we're going to be talking about Don's new book that he has out. Don was on the show, I think, was it 2 or 3 weeks ago? And right in the middle of the sentence, he froze. And I didn't know what was going on. We tried his phone. We went to break. We tried everything possible, and we couldn't even reach him no matter what, even late at night. He was just plain gone. And what it was a he had a lightning strike that hit a transformer, and his phone was connected to it and everything. So he's back tonight. Luckily, he was able to come back. I want to talk, before we get into the show, just quickly about a couple of things. First of all, we're live on Facebook as well. Every Tuesday night. So that's something we're simulcast both on YouTube and Facebook. Our Facebook page has a lot going on there. There's over 20,000 people and there's things posted every day. And Peggy's been helping out with that. She's been a great help all these years. And also, I want to talk about our blog this week. We have Friends from UFOs. That's by Charles Lear. And it's really fascinating. I had no idea how much Italy was involved in the contactee movement in the day. And he goes really deep into that. And I got to tell you something else. Charles is now recording audio of the blogs. So every, I would say a day or two after this podcast comes out, every week, as long as he does it, it's up to him to do it. But if he does do it, I will post them on the podcast feed. So anywhere you listen to this podcast, whether it's through iTunes, your iPod, iPad, however you listen, you will be able to pick up the audio blog as well. Without further ado, here I am. I look like the man in black again. I wasn't noticing. I have no backlight. So without further ado, I'm going to bring both our guests in. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi, Martin.
And welcome, Don.
Thank you for having me back, Mark.
So, you know, I look terrible. I mean, you can see the water behind me, but you can't see me. So I'm going to pull myself totally out of this. But I would like, actually, I can't do it because it'll mute my mic. So I would like to ask you to basically, Don, you were on, you kind of explained who you were and everything. Paul, do you mind giving the listener your background? And then, of course, we're going to be talking about your father.
Sure. Happy to be here with my good friend, Don Schmidt. And thanks. Martin, Don and I are quite familiar with Men in Black, so you look just fine to us.
Perfect. Good.
Yeah, so I'm the favorite fourth-born son of J. Allen Hynek and my mom, Mimi Hynek. I have sort of two hats. One is a CFO. I'm a Wharton MBA and a professor at Pepperdine, and I created financial projection software for startups. And on the other hat I wear is of UFOs. So I'm just very happy to be here and talk to you about my dad and whatever else I can fill in the little gaps that Don can't do ably himself.
Yeah, that's true. Don, so do you remember actually when you were working with J. Allen Hynek and with in CUFOs, do you remember seeing Paul? Because he was the favorite, I guess, right?
Yeah. On a number of occasions at the home on Ridge Avenue, as far as in Evanston, but never at the office. I don't know if he was being restricted by his mother and father for that reason, or I don't believe your interest was really that keen on the subject at that time, Paul, correct?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I grew up with UFOs, so it's never something I had to make active efforts to be involved with. It was always kind of spoon-fed. So I was at the office a fair amount, folding envelopes and the like, but I think my father felt at that point I wasn't an especially contributing presence.
Well, he was a discriminating professor, no question. But I'll say this to you. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't think to myself, now, what would Alan say or what would Alan do? The influence is such that it's grounded me to the extent that so many things that Dr. J. Alan Hynek would just step aside and he would go, irrelevant, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter what you think, because I'm not going to waste my time with it. And I just love the fact that he so often would tell us, now, you know, don't lose that little boy wonderment. The idea that, you know, every time you peer up at the stars at night, you know, just let your imagination go wild. And as you know better than anyone, Paul, your father had a vivid imagination. He just loved entertaining every possibility, you know, that was out there.
That's really great. Now, I'm going to, is that a cat? I thought I was hearing something. Wow.
That's my howler monkey associate.
Yeah. I thought that was a sound effect you had going or something. Do you remember, Paul, this question's for you. Do you remember your father at the point where all of a sudden he realized there was really something to this UFO thing, kind of where he sort of turned the corner? As from a skeptic to someone that really, do you actually remember those days or remember him talking about those days?
Well, that would have been a little bit after my sort of conscious awareness of the topic, you know, because I was born in the early 60s. So my older siblings remember him kind of wrestling with that and starting off as a confirmed skeptic. I wouldn't say he became a believer, as a lot of people say, because I don't think belief is really a word that scientists like to traffic in.
But that's
right. I'm a skeptic to an acceptor of the accumulated weight of the data.
Yes, I understand. I get corrected. You know, I have been corrected a number of times when I said the word belief, because, you know, you're right. It's they want to know the data and not believing into anything. A scientist isn't going to look to believe in anything. They just want to see the facts. I don't know if that's exactly right, but along those lines. But Don, when you were on the outside, now that's going way back. When did you first start working with Dr. Hynek?
In 1978. Ah. And I was a state director, field investigator for the area Aerial Phenomena Research Organization at that time, that actually had its foundings in Wisconsin before it went down to Tucson, founded by Coral and Jim Lorenzen. And I had written up a number of reports, and somehow one of them crossed Dr. Hynek's desk down at Kufos. And he invited me down to the residence. And it was the first time I actually had met with Dr. Hynek and his wife Mimi, and we hit it off very well. And I especially remember, you know, that we hit it off as far as our sense of humor, that we were even telling jokes to one another by the end of the evening. And within weeks, he was calling me up, assigning me a case. You know, Don, we have something that happened in Southern Illinois. If you have the time, I'd like you to look into it. That type of thing. And, you know, the rest just, I was coming down to the office from Wisconsin twice a week. And just there would be calls that would come into the office and Alan would go, here, Don, you take this one. And it would be a prank. It would be somebody, you know, just clearly, you know, just making some ridiculous. But that's how we were also enjoying one another's company. So as serious as it could be on one a plane, we were also trying to make light of it because we didn't have answers. So as a result, it was all we could do just to, you know, remain in contact with the outside world.
I'm going to ask this question. It's in our chat, and it might be a sensitive question. If it is, that's fine. But I don't know if either one of you know the answer to this. And that is, did Dr. Hynek really drop off software and equipment to Paul Benowitz? Do we know that to be a fact?
No. I never, and even those who worked with Benowitz, and when I, with APRO, because Benowitz, you know, worked with the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization at that time. And I've never heard anything suggested of that nature, no.
So that was actually about the same time that you were working with him. I think correct. It was 1979 or something like that with Benowitz, right?
That would be so, correct, yes.
Yeah, and yeah.
Just before Berlitz and Moore did Roswell Incident in 1980. And keeping in mind that Bill Moore, William Moore, was an investigator with APRO, and he was the one that was in direct contact with Benowitz on a regular basis. And for all the times I met with Moore, he never mentioned anything about Hynek in that regard, no.
Yeah, that's such a sad situation in general. But, you know, it really is a really good case for misinformation. And, you know, you wonder, you know, with Richard Doty and all the misinformation, and I'm still wondering if there may be an element of disinformation to this day. Some things that have been happening lately, it just makes me wonder about a few different people and a few different things that are being said. And have you seen, you've been at this pretty seriously, Don, for a long time, you know, besides Bill Moore, Richard Doty, have you seen a lot of cases where there was misinformation out there?
I wouldn't say a lot. I would say that these would be the exception. And it would involve typically cases that monetarily, potentially, would reap, a high reward as to the nature of a case. In so much as one could always ask, well, is it because you're getting too close? Like they knew too much about the flying saucers, that type of thing. And then you're talking, you're getting crossing over into the alleged men in black, phenomena, that type of thing. But as far as disinformation, I think it was normally a case of where it would involve overly zealous rogue individuals within the government or within the military that just saw easy individuals that they could manipulate and would pass off, phony documents and get away with it. We have to always, bear in mind that if it's the real article or if these people get caught, they open up, a Pandora's box that they may never close. It's a catch-22. So it's one thing to dangle a carrot and keep pulling it away, but the moment you start, putting out disinformation and you're held responsible, you're finally determined to be the source of that disinformation, no one's going to cover for you. That's when it's like he wasn't acting any orders on our part. He was a rogue. He was a maverick. He was doing this on his own. And I think that the latter is generally been the case. These are just rogue individuals that have always seen people within ufology that at times can be rather gullible. And I don't deny, I've been there myself. So, but that's the problem in dealing with something where we have no answers. Anytime someone, provides something that looks potentially good, we're going to be the first ones that look into it.
Yeah. I know you were just joking, Paul, about Men in Black, but did that topic... I'm being serious here. Did that topic ever come up in your household?
Absolutely.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Let's hear about that.
So my dad would recount how there were several cases where the witnesses would just clam up and say that they don't think they used the phrase men in black, but that they had been visited by some kind of intimidating presence. And my dad thought it was government, but, you know, we tend to think of the U.S. government as acting in one monolithic block, but nothing could be further from the truth. You have all these warring fiefdoms. I mean, the different branches of the service don't trust each other. Different elements within each service don't trust each other. So on the one hand, you have an officially sanctioned Air Force program ostensibly trying to find the truth, and is actually a PR exercise, and going out and investigating these cases. And on the other hand, you have these what seem to be government agents, maybe from the 4602nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron, or who knows, trying to squelch the information at the same time. So for me, the interesting aspect of that, assuming that they were real and that they were from an entity of the U.S. government, is that you seem to have various elements of the government working at cross purposes.
Yeah, a number of times I've wondered if there's some type of compartmentalized part of the government that may know a little more than other parts of the government, but it's awful hard to say. And we're going to be talking about Roswell a little bit later, but as far as something like that goes, we're talking a secret all the way back, something top secret all the way back to the Roswell era. How would something like that move forward in government? Would either one of you want to ponder how that would work? Like, how would it be carried on to the next generation to this day?
Within official circles, my concern for many years has been that the old order has not passed it down to the new. That all the deep, dark secrets regarding whether, you know, it be Roswell or some of the other, you know, more profound incidents, and especially if you're talking about recovery operations, acquiring of physical evidence, that they just haven't shared this outside of respective ranks. Paul is absolutely correct as far as the competition within even just the different branches of the military. I like to always point out that when Project Blue Book disbanded, actually at the end of 1969, and we can get into his dad still being kept on a short leash for the next few years, even after Blue Book shut down. But when Blue Book was finally declassified in 1977, and for example, it would refer to over 20 gun camera cases. Okay, it lists them, but where's the actual footage? Where's the film? Well, you know, that was never declassified. Some of the photograph cases, they would reference, but again, where were the photographs? But most interesting of all was the fact that Blue Book declassifies 13,000 cases that they supposedly investigated. Where were all the Army cases, all the Navy cases, the Marine Corps, National Guard, that type of thing? I'm sure it wasn't just strictly an Air Force phenomenon. And in reality, the Navy even had greater coverage on a global basis. They weren't restricted to, you know, airspaces, you know, or respective countries, that type of thing. And yet, it was almost 99% Air Force. So personally, I believe there's still a wealth of material out there within Navy files, within the Army, within the Air Corps, the Marine Corps. And lest we forget, Roswell back in 1947 was an Army incident. It was the United States Army. The Air Force didn't even exist back at that time.
Right, the right. Army.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's really pretty interesting that they can move forward with this type of thing. And, you know, where are the films and all the, you know, the files that from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, either one of you, but some of the cases did not go to Project Blue Book. They went somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that they were probably some of the better cases. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think especially as of 1953, the sort of facade of Blue Book as any kind of serious scientific exercise had worn off. And those cases probably went to the 4602nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron. You know, those squadrons had the responsibility of getting anywhere in the continental United States within 6 hours.
Wow.
For a crash site, a crash of anything. And they had Russian speakers with them as well. So I think by that point, if there was any serious effort to capture something, reverse engineer, it wasn't in the hands of Blue Book, which was more a PR exercise to tamp down post-war hysteria.
I'm really pleased that, Paul, you've mentioned the 4602nd a number of times, because people just always resigned themselves to accept that it was strictly the Air Force and it was strictly Project Blue Book, and there was nothing outside of that purview, so to speak. But even your dad would meet with the 4602nd, and he would argue with them because it was quite clear to him, and as he would even lament to us, that the hardcore cases, as he would put it, were not going to Blue Book. They were going elsewhere. And that your dad, time and time again, he would talk to SAC officers, Strategic Air Command officers, and military and commercial pilots, and they would describe to him some of the most profound cases. And yet he would go down the right path in Dayton, Ohio, and wade through, you know, the previous month's reports, and he'd expect to see those cases. And they were never there. Well, where did they go? Well, your dad knew where they went. They were not going to Blue Book, because Blue Book was nothing more than a PR front. I mean, your dad saw that early on. And one would then ask, well, why did he stay on? Well, he wanted to, as he would say, be close to the data. He fully wanted to be there if there ever was an end game. If the race were ever to end, he still wanted to be in the race. And if he would have walked away at any time, he knows they would have cut him off, that they would have cut him off altogether. So he had to play both sides within the scientific community and within his top secret classification with Project Blue Book. But did he know for a fact that he was not having access to the hardcore data? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you're right, Don. I think my father felt there were three communities he had to be cognizant of. And you mentioned two of them, the mainstream scientific community, the military and government, and also UFO believers. Yes. And I think he felt he had to keep each of them at least mildly displeased, and then he was doing an adequate balancing act.
What did your, as far as you know, Paul, what did your father think about, you mentioned possible crashed UFOs. Was that something that came up that you were aware of?
Sure, because for the most part, my father realized that Don and he and others weren't studying UFOs. They were studying UFO reports. So it's like one level removed. And that's sort of the insight that helped him come up with the classification system of close encounters of the first, second, and third kind.
Right.
So as a scientist, as an astrophysicist, trained in nuts and bolts Newtonian physics, crashes and data and evidence, whether it's radar corroboration or gun camera footage or, you know, a blessed actual piece of evidence, that's something that a scientist would jump towards.
Wow, interesting.
And I think, and Paul, you're absolutely correct in that your father was actually becoming more and more intrigued with the possibility of crash retrievals, just as I was becoming involved with him. And that was also at the time that the late Leonard Stringfield presented his paper in Dayton, Ohio, on his crash retrieval investigations. And your father just literally hounded Len for the release of his source information. Your dad wanted to talk to these very witnesses, whether military or not. And it was something that until your father died that he had a tremendous fascination with. And we'll get into it more in specifics But for those who would suggest that Alan Hynek totally poo-pooed the notion that we were dealing with a nuts and bolts physical craft of sorts, no, then they're demonstrating they never knew the man.
Wow. Interesting. I just wanted to post this up. Is this so, Paul? Did your brother invent the bullet dodge for Neo in the Matrix?
Yes, that's right. And it's a long story, but he should have won the Oscar for that. But he won the Oscar for the movie after he created and conceived Bullet Time and the other effects in the Matrix. He went to another movie, and his assistant won the Oscar for the Matrix, but he won the Oscar for the other movie, which is What Dreams May Come.
Wow. Isn't that something? Boy, what a creative family you have. That's really something. So, Paul, what was it? Was your house a place where other kids wanted to hang out to see what there was? I mean, it must have been a really cool house.
Yeah.
Talking about UFOs or what was UFOs like on the table all the time? Or was it a subject your father wanted to kind of keep to himself, or was he open with it?
Our house was a gathering spot for many years for both scientific discussions and ribald parties. UFOs was a fascination of my father. I mean, when he got involved, he was an astrophysicist and rocket scientist and professor of astronomy. And when he was originally asked by the Air Force to help them, I don't know if they used the word study UFOs. I think he probably thought it was a few weekends worth of time, not even a bona fide side hustle. So, you know, he's known for that now in some circles, but he was a scientist. And so he got into it. And I think he had no idea that Don and I would be talking with you, Martin, you know, decades later about this part of his life. It's fascinating. It's one of the biggest questions ever to face mankind. And he helped, I think, push the needle that much farther on our collective understanding of what this phenomena represents and what it may be. It wasn't something that, you know, a lot of Blue Book, as Don mentioned, wasn't classified even at the time. And my father really didn't feel that he had to hide things from us. He also didn't want to force it down our throats. I mean, my parents, they came from a generation where they wouldn't initiate a lot of conversations about themselves and what they did and what they felt. It just was sort of unseemly to do that. So a lot of things that I know about my parents, both of them, are things I found out from people like Don and others. But otherwise, we had to actively ask questions, and we were fascinated by UFOs. I mean, if your dad's going around the world, and I never met anybody who traveled as much as he did, and coming back with trinkets from Bora Bora and, you know, and South Africa, it's fascinating. And then he starts telling you about people like Father Gill, who came to the house for dinner, and these fantastical reports. And you see, you know, my mother editing copies of the International UFO Reporter on the dining room table. You're just drawn into it.
Wow. That's really awesome.
Your mother, in many regards, ran the office, because your father, and I remember, he was on the road practically every 4 days. And I'll never forget when he was up in Hestalen. That was probably the last major trip he made. And describing how they were trudging through knee-deep snow to get to the camp. And he came back with just a bad cold, bad head cold. And I drove him out to dinner that particular night, and I could see that he wasn't feeling well, that there seemed to be something else. But the one thing that I believe, and it was the case with the Hudson Valley sightings in the latter years of his life, that Jenny Zeidman, who was his private secretary, who would accompany, who actually drive him down from Northwestern down to Wright Pat every month to go through, wade through the reports. And we agreed that it was like Alan was able to get out and play cowboys and Indians all over again. He loved being out in the field. He loved the interaction with actual eyewitnesses, that which he was not able to experience himself. He was living it. He was experiencing it through others. And he never tired of that. And it was just wonderful to see him in those last years that he once again was out in the field doing what he really set the model for the rest of us.
Yeah. Wow. He helped 12 observatories around the world.
We got some feedback. So what you're going to have to do, Paul, is go into your – actually, you're going to have to jump out of this room and then come back, set up your mic and come back in. So just leave studio. Wait a minute. You sound okay now. Go ahead. Try.
How's that?
Sounds good now. Go ahead.
Okay. It's the cover up. They're trying to shut us down, Don.
They got me last time. So
they sure did. Boy. Yeah.
You know, he had set up 12 observatories around the world as part of the optical satellite tracking program and actually started the first sort of citizen scientist program. So he was very used to traveling. And our mutual friend, Calvin Parker,
yes,
told the story when we were on your show before, Martin, which I hadn't heard before, that he had his famous sighting in Pascagoula with Charlie Hickson in 1973. Right. And he got out of the police station at around 11:30 p.m. on a Sunday night. He and Charlie show up to work, which I think is amazing, at like 7 a.m. the next day. And my father was waiting in the human resource office to talk to them. Mm-hmm. Wow. And so Calvin to this day doesn't know how my father got there that quickly. I think he must have been on the Gulf Coast on business anyways, but still it's kind of amazing how quickly he got there. But he had, you know, he's a little Czech boy from Chicago who loved trains and he loved traveling. So the idea of going out into the field, like Don said, and living vicariously through witnesses' eyes on site was not something he had to be arm twisted into.
So I did want to talk about Father Gill, but before that, all this that we're talking about, how was he getting his funding at this point? And through CUFOS, did they have some funding to do all this traveling? You're talking about, you know, every 4 days he's somewhere else. I mean, that takes some money.
I've not often heard the word funding associated with CUFOS. So I think probably partly from CUFOS, but a lot of it was just his own pocket, or he would attach investigations to speaker trips where he was paid.
Right.
Wow.
That's exactly what he did. He would have a speaker fee and connect it as far as to some additional work. Let me stay another day or two while I'm here, that type of thing. And as far as the associates at CUFOS, yeah, we had the International UFO Reporters, so they became associates. So there it wasn't a membership as much as it was where they contributed to the field in that regard. And so whenever there was field work specifically involving Dr. Hynek or our chief investigator at that time, Alan Hendry, that CUFOS often would cover the bill. But more times than not, just like, as Paul knows, the investigators, it was all, you know, out of pocket. And we realized it wasn't sending our receipts, our check stubs or anything as far as to the office for reimbursement. It was truly a labor of love in that regard. And we also wanted to make Dr. Hynek proud. And that was another inspiration in getting the job done.
Ah, wow. Wow, that's amazing. So, Paul, I'm going to ask you this question. As far as Project Blue Book, the series, you know, there was not as many people complaining about it the first year as the second year. And what the people who were complaining, I want to say, were the people in the UFO field. And the reason they were complaining was because they were they weren't liking how much fiction there was involved. And I know you had a lot of input. What were your thoughts about the last season? I understand they're not, there's no season three at this point.
Yeah, there was, you know, it's an interesting premise to start with real people and largely real, let's say, reported events and visualize things that you don't really see when you read a typewritten report. And then, yeah, add on another layer of dramatization. You know, my family, we had a lot of discussions about should my brother Joel and I be consultants on the show as we were. And we decided, look, this show was going to happen with or without us. we might as well be involved, kind of like my father was with Project Blue Book, and not control, but try to influence it in a direction that we thought was not necessarily, good for my father and mother, but accurate. That's all we wanted. And so we were happy with the show. And the idea was that they would portray through fantastic performances by Aidan Gillen and Laura Minnelli as TV mom and TV dad, that they would sort of represent the authentic parts of my parents, not necessarily accurate. So that you put the sort of authentic kernels of these characters in these stretched circumstances, and they will react more or less as my parents would have done in real life had they confronted, you know, Wernher von Braun's teleporting ship or aliens in water and all that. And, you know, people would complain largely in the UFO community. Oh, they didn't get the Gorman dogfight right. They banked left when they should have banked right. Those details are lost on 99% of the viewing public who don't know anything about the cases. And, you know, the creative element behind the show were huge UFO buffs. Sean Jablonski, the showrunner, David O'Leary, the creator, Arturo and Terry, the first network exec, and the cast were very much interested in UFOs and wanted to present the phenomena in a respectful way. And the interesting thing about a work like this that contains elements of fiction is that it kind of opens up the tent for a larger discussion, kind of like Close Encounters, the movie, did back in its day, because, you know, books and documentaries about UFOs aren't always bringing in new people, but a work of fiction, people can come for the adventure and stay for the UFOs. And I think it, you know, like the movie Close Encounters, and I think now Project Blue Book have made more people feel comfortable talking about these extraordinary and often traumatic experiences that they had. So we were happy with the show. And for me, one of the more resonant parts was in season 6 of episode 2, I have a cameo in the episode about Close Encounters. So I have a cameo in the show about my father in the episode about the movie based on my father's work in which he had a cameo.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's season 6, you say?
Yeah, so if you watch it, episode 6 of season 2.
I got it.
Image you see as TV mom and TV dad are walking to the camera is this roguishly handsome cameraman being lifted up in a crane. And I kind of stole the scene by how well I sat there, I think.
I'll have to catch that. Wow, amazing.
Paul, I wanted to say that's probably the best explanation I've heard. In not so much defending the series, but explaining not only what the creative license that Hollywood is so proficient in demonstrating, but that it also served the UFO community quite well by, again, appealing to, by attracting a whole new audience. I think too many people within the field are just so complacent and just accepting that, well, it's just a set number that we have to appeal to and we have to win over. And I was beyond that, 20 years ago. You know, we're beyond preaching to the choir, so to speak. But I wanted to ask, there had been a bit of a groundswell movement as far as and a push to potentially bring it back on another a cable channel or something. Is that still in the works, or without revealing anything, is this something that's still possible?
I think it is still possible, and there's interest in that. It's a challenging environment now with COVID to sort of reboot production on any network. So yeah. I don't know of the latest. I'm still in touch with the folks there, but I haven't heard any news recently.
I spoke with Dave O'Leary, I don't know, maybe a month ago, and he said, you know, they were trying. And he said the exact same thing about COVID. And I don't even know how you would actually film, you know, something new during these times.
You know, what you do is you do a sort of quarantine. You take all the cast, you get them all tested, you have them all quarantined for a couple of weeks, and then you start production on a closed set.
I see.
It's not an easy thing to do.
Right.
And it certainly increases the expense, yes.
Yeah. Right. Here come the turkeys again.
And we're not talking about Don and I, are you?
Yeah. Here come the turkeys. Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. You both were connected to such an amazing man. And did you actually hear and remember the time? I know you were 8 or 9 years old, something like that, when Project Blue Book actually, you know, the real Project Blue Book shut down. And when that happened, what was the reaction like, that if you remember it?
You know, the writing had been on the wall for a long time, and the Condon Committee, you know, the military has a lot of deference for academic community, and they try to sort of shield themselves from blowback by saying this or that professor did something. Now, for anybody who's read the Condon Committee report, which was the official pretext in 1969 to shut down Project Blue Book, it's a startling document because the conclusions do not jibe with the evidence in the report itself. So it is not, it is a piece of scientific dishonesty of the highest degree. So my father knew full well that it was winding to a close, and he was sort of preparing, as Don talked about, to be able to use that data. And while he was there, you know, he was able to influence somewhat the cases that they investigated, but also somewhat how they investigated them, but have sort of a first row seat to all the cases. So when it shut down, it was no great surprise. And, you know, just 4 years later, my dad and others formed the Center for UFO Studies to go at it in a much more unfettered fashion.
Really, really interesting. Let's see, we had someone that actually sent me a text, and he wanted to know how the money trail could identify hidden UFO research programs. Is it, do either one of you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I could quickly give the example of the accountant who was at the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947. And when he was interviewed and he was able to recollect, he was quite vocal about the fact that for the recovery of a just simple weather balloon device, they sure spent a lot of money back at that time. That it appeared to him as though it was a full-blown operation of a scope close to that of, you know, a errant atomic bomb, you know, detonation, that type of thing. And so when you make a good point, we've had other we've had witnesses, for example, suggest that, well, check back to the local police and fire department, and you'll see that they were called out, or that there was an immediate increase as far as in expenses as a result of an investigation of something that the Air Force may have poo-pooed. They may have denied even happened. So it at least demonstrates a money trail. It's a question mm-hmm. of what the expenses, you know, accrued towards, and if it was the actual UFO incident or not. But in the case of Roswell, yes, the accountant at the Roswell Army Airfield said that there was a tremendous expense that expenses went up tremendously during that week of the recovery operation, and then it hardly would reflect the recovery of just a lone weather balloon device.
Wow, that's interesting. I'm going to ask both of you maybe whether you'll agree on this question or not. But right off the bat, Paul's shaking. Both of you saying no. what do you think J. Allen Hynek's the case, a UFO incident that shook him the most? I don't know which one you want to talk about that first.
Well, as long as Paul's thinking, I think I'll just jump in.
Take a while, Don. You got time.
It was the Socorro, New Mexico in 1964. Mm-hmm. And even the Air Force report, in referring to it as a vehicle, they weren't denying it was a physical piece of hardware that touched down. to the south, west of Socorro at that time. And Paul's dad was immediately, you know, assigned to the case by the Air Force. And Alan Hynek even talking about by the time he arrived at the sage, that the brush where the object had touched down, you could still feel the heat. It was still there. The depressions in the ground. And it was a case that affected him so profoundly that I think it was the final straw. It was like, now, how do you explain this away? And Alan would talk about that. He, for example, he tried all he could. He pulled out all stops in trying to explain Socorro prosaically, conventionally. And he couldn't. And neither could the Air Force. Major Hector Quintanilla was the last director of Project Blue Book at that time. And Alan Hynek would tell us that he was a nasty officer. And he was, because he would go out of his way to not only discredit the witnesses, but humiliate them, make them feel as though that they were wasting his time by even making a report. But even Quintanilla couldn't explain away Socorro as much as he tried. So I think what I observed personally, and then what Alan would talk to us about afterwards, that it was Socorro that finally, you know, was that that linchpin that pulled him over from the dark side.
Yeah, I'll second that. And as I see that Tim Chan mentioned in the chat room, which is ably moderated by Dave Altman, my father had a lot of credibility or felt that Lonnie Zamora was a very credible witness. And that attitude, he's this very salt of the earth police guy who wasn't looking for this, didn't seek to benefit from it afterwards, and was truly traumatized, but still had that sort of military bearing of being able to recount the affair.
Yes.
In fact, right after the incident happened, which is seldom reported, the very first place that Lonnie Zamora went was to his parish priest. He went to church because he felt he had observed, he had witnessed something demonic, that it was so unearthly that he felt that maybe it was spiritual in nature. Well, going back and the footprints in the sand, the landing depressions, that type of thing, convinced him otherwise shortly thereafter. But nonetheless, it was something that truly, you know, affected him as far as on that spiritual level. Yes.
One thing I want to say, let's do this. One thing I wanted to say, I know you can't see me. I look like I'm in the witness protection program still.
We won't talk, Martin. We promise we won't talk.
when your father was there, or J. Allen Hynek, Don, when he was there with Lonnie Zamora, supposedly he actually saw the rock. It was Lonnie who first saw the rock that had a scrape on it with the metal on it. And the question is, why didn't your dad want to pick up that rock and take that rock and have it analyzed? Did you ever hear about that? I mean, he actually, supposedly it was Lonnie Zamora that said the rock over there has a scrape on it with metal. And your father supposedly commented something along the lines, I see, yeah, you're right, or something like that, but they didn't remove the rock. Did you ever hear anything about that?
And I did. In fact, even the late Mary Zamora, Lonnie's wife, who just died end of last year.
Of COVID, actually.
So the report is, yes.
Yeah.
She had talked about the rock. Lonnie had talked about the rock. And there was even a search at the Zamora home at one point, still looking for a fragment of the rock that may have had remnants of that metal trace still there. Not found, not discovered. But one thing we have to keep in mind, Alan Hynek was still the consultant to the Project Blue Book. He was there on assignment for Blue Book. He was at their beck and call. In fact, one of the things that one of the police officers would describe how everybody arriving on the scene of the landing, they totally obliterated the footprints that had, that were there.
Wow.
The child size, you know, the two beings that were seen in conjunction with this egg-shaped craft that was standing there. And I've had witnesses since then sketch me what they saw as to the size, that they were footprints the size of a 10-year-old, you know, child, that type of thing. But totally obliterated, again, by all these amateurs who were not part of the investigation. Well, these pictures that were taken and the sketches that were done, and when you would talk to the reporters, some of the people who were involved, family members of the police officers who were called in to see what had this fantastic event that just took place. And when I would ask, well, where did everything go? Where did all the pictures, where did the film, where did the drawings all go? Well, they were all confiscated, I would be told. And the one person they said who went to the newspaper, who went to the eyewitnesses and grabbed everything while they still could, and I'm told the same person over and over again, was J. Allen Hynek. That Hynek was instructed by the officers with Blue Book to gather up every piece of testimony, every photograph, every drawing he could while they were still there. And I'm sure days, weeks, and years later, Allen Hynek often would think to himself, boy, I should have made copies, or I should have stuck a few things in my pockets, because he was a good, for not being military, he was still a good soldier working for the military.
Yeah, we have to go to break in about 3 minutes from now. But one of the questions that comes up a lot when it comes to this particular case, the Socorro incident, is that it was possibly hours. You know, any thoughts on that, either one of you?
Don, you're on a roll.
Well, but quickly, it does not account for the fact that there was another sighting the very next night in La Madera. It doesn't account for the fact that there were sightings throughout New Mexico describing almost a similar shaped craft during that entire week. It's just that the Socorro one received, garnered all the publicity, all the attention. This notion that it was a lunar module, the LEM, or that it was even a staged prank by students at the mining, you know, university in Socorro at that time, just, again, it's grasping at straws.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You have to keep in mind that the Air Force and Hector Quintanilla, for everything they did to try to explain this away, they could not, and that Dr. Hynek went out of his way because he didn't want this to be a legitimate case, because he wanted to once again prove that if you investigate anything to the 11th degree, if you have enough data, you can come up with a solid conventional explanation. No one could. And that's the point. To this day, Socorro, New Mexico stands at one of the best UFO cases in the United States of all time.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things that, you know, people that are questioning that saying that as a possibility, they don't keep in mind is that the figures that Lonnie supposedly saw were so tiny, diminutive. And, you know, they're not going to have someone handling a craft that is, you know, a child, so to speak. I mean, they look the size of a 10-year-old child or something like that, if I have it right.
Exactly.
And that's just not going to happen. So, yeah, I think that is definitely, I always say that's one of my top five favorite cases is definitely the Socorro case. It's just...
And you'd have a lot of agreement throughout the UFO community on that. One of the top five cases of all time.
Yeah, and Ray Stanford wrote a beautiful book on that. Did a very good job on that. I still have that in my library. So anyway, we are ready to go into break. And so hang in there, everyone, over at KGR. A radio. We're going to be back right after these messages. And for you, those of you on YouTube, I got a special treat, and here it is.
There was a time when people would sight flying saucers, and wherever they made reports, they were sometimes treated or ridiculed or called wackos or crazy people. What Dr. Hynek and his people are trying to do is present a forum where people can present the most unusual sightings and have them treated with dignity and without fear of being ridiculed. Would you please welcome from the Center of UFO Studies in Evanston, Illinois, Dr. J. Allen Hynek. Dr. Hynek. When you first get a when you first get a report of a sighting, is your job to assemble evidence that will prove it to be so, or to assemble evidence to prove that it did not happen? You know, there are two ways to go on any investigation.
The first thing we do is to try to disprove it. Mm-hmm. Because what is the point of establishing, of perpetuating a myth or something that isn't so? And it turns out that some 90% of the raw reports, see, we have a nationwide police network, an 800 number that the police use, and we get reports every night from police departments or different parts of the country. Most of them are planets, twinkling stars.
Explainable or identifiable things.
The IFOs, we call them, identifiable flying objects. But that remaining 10%, those are the ones we go after. Now, a UFO, the U in UFO, of course, simply means unidentified. It does not necessarily mean visitors from outer space. But it must be unidentified not just to the person who is puzzled by it, but it must remain unidentified after considerable study. Then and only then is it a UFO.
What are you investigating right now? What have been some things that have come up in the last couple of months that you're looking into?
Well, we have a very interesting case in Muscatine, Iowa, just comes to mind. Sometimes, you know, animals are the first things to give warning that something strange is going on.
Oh, anytime. In California, for example, before an earthquake, the animal kingdom is aware of it long before we are. That's true.
Now, we had a letter from a chap saying that what first called my attention to something going on was the fuss that the horses were raising in the barn. But this time it's rabbits. It's a rather interesting story. There is a chap that runs a toll gate at Muscatine, Iowa, across the river there. And he runs from the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift.
Works the all night, too. Okay.
Yeah. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, it has been his custom for quite a while to feed the wild rabbits. He takes carrots and tosses them out, and the rabbits grab a carrot and dash off. At this time, at 10 minutes to 3, he goes out there, and the rabbits are just lying flat and immobile on the cement. Not dead.
Okay.
But just as though they were petrified, paralyzed. And simultaneously, as soon as he sees that, he hears a humming sound, loud humming sound, and a large yellow object rises from across the river and comes across. And the whole thing lasted for some 6 minutes. As soon as it was gone, the rabbits jumped back to life and scurried off. And also, at the same time, we're still investigating, there was a concomitant power outage in Muscatine. Now, we don't know whether that had anything to do with the UFO mm-hmm. or not, but it may have.
Usually there is some kind of a power fluctuation or power outage.
So those are the sorts of things that we investigate.
Mm-hmm. All right. And but you have no, the jury's still out on this one.
Jury's still out on that one, yeah.
Well, I just love that clip. We're live on YouTube right now for the next, I don't know, we got to say 45 seconds or something like that. And Bill will be letting us know when we go back live. But that's such an awesome clip. I just wanted to say that was 1979.
The rabbits.
And that was I'm the show was 1979 with Tom Snyder. Tom was a neighbor of mine when I lived in California, a real nice guy. But he loved J. Allen Hynek on the show. He thought those were one of his better shows. Do you remember, Paul, do you remember watching him as a kid when he was on TV shows?
Yeah.
And wasn't he on not to tell the truth, but or something like that?
Yeah, to tell the truth. Yes.
All right. I am back with the two guests. I have Paul Hynek and Don Schmidt, and we're having a good night. And I still look like I'm in the witness protection program out here. I believe I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. I was hoping the sun would kind of go over this way, and you know, but it's working against me tonight. I'll have to keep that in mind. But no mosquitoes here in Maine. I can't believe it. So I'm lucky so far. We still have an hour to go, though. So, and I just want to let you know, in the last half hour of the show, we are going to be taking calls. So, so that should be interesting, to say the least. So, Paul, this question's for you. You're growing up in this household, and what was a day-to-day life like? Now, I heard someone say this in correct me if it's wrong. I mean, it probably is wrong, but they said that Mimi, your mother, had no interest in UFOs. Is that?
Oh, that's categorically false. Yeah.
That is. Yeah. Now, you know, I heard that on a either a show or something, but she actually had an interest.
Oh, yeah, more than an interest. You know, Don already mentioned that she pretty much ran the Center for UFO Studies for some time, and she was the editor of the International UFO Reporter. You know, I think she played a central role because for some people, my father might be a little bit hard to relate to. He was an absent-minded astrophysicist. And my mom was a salt of the earth woman from Ohio. And I think a lot of people felt that if Mimi Hynek, somebody like that, who was working with the juvenile court in Chicago and, you know, was the chairman of the Cook County League of Women Voters, was not only interested, but working actively in the field in her own right, then maybe there's something to it here.
Wow. Did she actually ever look into anything seriously herself, any footwork?
Yes. I mean, she was very active. You know, I think my father was kind of the visionary who sort of liked to shine a light for mainstream science a little bit farther and try to push the understanding or the acceptance of mainstream science a little bit towards the sort of jaggedy edges of the field. And I think my mom was the one that would sort of come in and make order and rules and make it more sort of established. But anybody who knew her, and Don, I sure can second this, would say that she was quite actively involved and fascinated by the topic.
Oh, wow. Totally, totally. In fact, she often, for the monographs that Kupos would publish, like on the coin helicopter case or like the Russian UFO phenomena, that type of thing, she often would do the actual editing of these publications. And she was very much involved as far as with the monthly at that time magazine, International UFO Reporter. So she would even get into the field. One of the most, you know, wonderful experiences with Mimi Hynek was after Ellen had passed away. So this would be 3 years later. And we had our first archaeological dig at the Roswell debris field.
1989 or so.
Yeah, September of 89. And we were, KUFO sponsored the project. Argonne Laboratories, we had two archaeologists from Argonne, our scientific director, who had succeeded as far as Alan was Dr. Mark Brodiger. But who was there who came over from Scottsdale and pretty much was our cook, our Chuck Wick, you know, cook at the site, who was just as much involved on her hands and knees and with the trowels and with the shaker boxes, but Paul's mother, Mimi. And as often as we would be out there in the hot desert sun, and Mimi would be sitting there with us, and every so often she would look at us and she would go, "Alan would be so proud of you boys." Because we weren't sitting behind a desk. We were actually out in the field trying to make things happen. We were looking for the evidence, not expecting the phone to ring and somebody to drop it in our lap, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that was the one thing that Alan had always taught us. And here we were doing it. And there she was, his wife, his widow, participating with us. And she felt right at home. She felt like it's exactly what he would wanted her to also be doing at the time. So it was just a wonderful, wonderful, you know, experience that I will never forget.
Wow. That makes me happy to hear that. There you can see the question up there from Mary Grace. She wanted to know if Mimi ever had a UFO sighting herself, or Paul or Joel. For that fact, did Jay Allen ever have a sighting?
He had two. I don't know if he would use the word sightings. He saw something twice, one from an airplane and once in Canada. You know, and he took a picture of the one from the airplane, but he didn't like to talk too much about things that he had seen because his value to the field was as a third-party objective referee, let's say. Mm-hmm. And the more he would talk about something that he saw, especially a single person encounter, it's not that valuable, because many other people have reported seeing things. He's not very much different. Maybe he's a little bit more astronomically informed, but his sighting isn't worth that much more than anybody else's, if any at all. So he wasn't that comfortable talking about things he himself had seen. I'm not aware of my mom seeing anything. And I can say my brother Joel and I haven't seen anything that we think would rise to the level of a bona fide sighting.
Well, interesting. And, you know, that doesn't matter. I've mentioned this on this show before. You know, for the people that look into this topic, you know, I've never asked you, Don, if you ever had a sighting. I don't think it matters whether someone has had a sighting or not. It's such a fascinating topic. And there's so much evidence, more or less, out there that something is definitely going on.
Well, I believe we've all seen things in a nighttime sky that maybe for a moment you let your imagination go with it. But nothing that I would have reported, nothing that I would have, you know, would ever claim I actually saw the genuine article. But you're absolutely right, Martin. I mean, how can anyone, you know, turn away from this subject? You're talking about the biggest story of the millennium. And my biggest regret is that the Alan Hynek's, and specifically Alan Hynek, that if we are getting any nearer to any form of disclosure, that he wasn't there, he's not here to receive all the due credit that he deserves.
Wow.
Because I was there at times when, as I mentioned earlier, when they would dangle that carrot. And Paul certainly remembers that being in the Chicago area, there was some wonderful media outlets at that time. Alan had a wonderful series of media contacts. He had wonderful support from the Chicago media, the likes of Eddie Schwartz and David Susskind.
Earl Cupson
as far as in that market. And as a result, whenever they would get a tip, they would get something that, you know, potentially was coming down the pipe that there was going to be some type of an announcement regarding the very subject, they would immediately contact, Alan. And I can remember, like, during the Carter, during the Ford administration was the first time, and then during the Carter administration, that, and that was the one that I was around at the time, that he would be, you know, quickly, you know, raced down to WGN in Chicago. And both times, it was called off. It didn't happen. And he was never discouraged as much as, well, he would come away going, well, not tonight, but maybe tomorrow night, or maybe next month, maybe next year. One of these times it's going to happen. I don't think he ever felt like he was being used or toyed with. He just, again, he wanted to be there when that announcement, you know, was actually made.
Wow. Well, you know, I see there's a lot more scientists actually taking this topic serious enough to look into it. I see the progression, and I think we are in a very interesting time to be involved in this topic, and it's really, really great. So as far as the things that J. Alan Hynek would appreciate today, do you think he would be just shocked that you know, the Pentagon supposedly had a program investigating UFOs, and they actually are allowing the public to know about it?
I think this gets back to the idea of different parts of the government acting in different ways with different desires. You know, the Air Force was, in my father's capacity with them, was nonstop obstructionist. They just wanted to stamp solved on every case. And even though the quote best cases were siphoned off, the 12,000 odd cases that Blue Book took on, even with this huge mission imperative to explain everything away, they still couldn't explain about 5% of the cases. And this is not a, you know, a scientifically credible fashion. So the Air Force, basically their job was to convince people that they've got our backs. There's no threat posed to us from whatever these things may be. Please disperse and go away. Now you have the Navy saying, yes, we've seen hundreds of these things. We don't know what to do with them. We don't even know how to report them. And by the way, here are some legitimate videos. Can you help us? I mean, that is a completely different stance. And, you know, Don mentioned disclosure. You know, that is tantamount to disclosure there, such that we're waiting on confirmation. But I think my father would be gratified that, for example, the Close Encounters classification system has persevered and has been expanded upon. That's been a help to the field. But I think he'd be downright flabbergasted by this open attitude from the Navy and the Pentagon, as expressed in the newspaper of record, the New York Times, which used to be such a poo-pooer of the phenomenon.
That's right. That's right. Your dad was also, going way back to 1953, he was something like an associate or something for the Robertson panel.
Yeah.
And for basically for the anyone that is not familiar with that, the Robertson panel was formed in 1953, basically to stop the, I don't want to say panic, but there were a lot of people that were really reporting UFOs dramatically, and they wanted to kind of figure out a way to explain them away to calm the public down. I'm sort of hitting on the outside, but in a nutshell, that's kind of what it was. So your dad was involved in that. And did he have, and did he move forward? I mean, he did move forward actually in trying to explain things away for a while. And eventually he got fed up with that, right?
Yeah. There's not much of a future in explaining things away. So, you know, he was loyal and, you know, he had worked on the proximity fuse with the Air Force in World War II. So, you know, we think of the government and we have highly fractious views of the government, and the credibility in the government has eroded tremendously. There's a Gallup poll not long ago that more than 2/3 of Americans feel the government knows a lot more about UFOs than they're letting on. But, you know, my father, you know, in the late 40s and early 50s, people, especially scientists, had a different view towards the military. So I think he went in there thinking, okay, this would be a short piece of work. I'll help the Air Force. I'll do my patriotic duty. And it became clear to him pretty quickly that such was not the case.
Wow. Interesting.
And Paul does make an excellent point in that, keeping in mind post-World War II, the military walked on water.
Yes.
As far as the country was concerned.
Right.
And that he was in many ways, and Dr. Hynek was at Ohio State at the time, so he was just down the road from Wright-Patterson. That was Wright Field at the time. But
Wright Field, yeah.
Ohio. Mm-hmm. And so he just saw it as a job initially. He just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And Paul is absolutely correct. He thought, and Alan would refer to it, that he thought it was just part of the silly season, as they would call it back then. That it was just going to be this fad that would, you know, through the summer of 47, and that would be the extent of it. But getting back to quickly the Robertson panel, Dr. Hynek would talk to us. We would describe how, you know, he sat there at the panel discussions with the CIA convening as far as the Robertson panel. And he would then talk about, not once did they ask my opinion on anything. That I just basically sat there for 2 days, not saying a word, because I was in the room, but they acted like they could have cared less. They had their preconceived as far as determination. They knew what they were going to as far as conclude, as far as what was the true danger, as Paul was alluding to, the reports tying up communication lines, and the Soviets at that time could have staged a fake invasion and distracted us in one direction as they actually invaded the United States, that type of thing. But again, Alan Hynek saw through it. He knew that they had no interest in the actual phenomena. It was, again, part of how can we stall and delay? How can we keep the press from nipping at our ankles? Because the sightings are going to continue no matter what. And that's all Alan Hynek was interested in. He wasn't interested in the politics. He wasn't interested even so much as the military response. He was interested strictly in the science of it. And that's what he taught all of us, the science behind the very realization that we're dealing with a phenomenon off the planet.
Wow. Do you know when he was, before he was ever contacted for any of these programs, did he ever even think of the topic of these, well, I don't want to call them UFOs, but, you know, I think, was it him that actually coined that phrase too, Paul, UFO?
First part of your question, I don't think he thought much about UFOs before Project Blue Book. I don't know of anything to indicate that. And I don't think he came up with UFOs. It may have been Edward Ruppelt.
It was
Ruppelt. That's right. You're right. Yeah. You're right now.
It was my dad. That was Ruppelt, first director of Blue Book. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I do remember that now. But so this must really be interesting for someone that has no interest in it and has a science background, but is made kind of pushed into looking at the topic. And then to see the whole thing evolve between one side and, you know, I'm sure you don't want me to bring up the swamp gas, but, you know, you see him evolve through all that and then get on to the other side.
I would be happy to even comment on that because it was something he never lived down. You're talking about the Dexter Ann Arbor sightings in Michigan in 1966. And Alan always described how the moment he arrived on the scene, again, on assignment, he came straight up as far as from Dayton, Ohio, from Wright Patt. He had a briefing there and went right up to Michigan. And at the moment he got off the plane, he was surrounded by reporters. They were literally grabbing on him, I mean, physically pulling on him for an answer, for a response to these sightings that had even garnered the attention of the then Michigan Congressman Gerald Ford. And it was only one specific sighting that happened to be over a farmer's field. It was a very marshy area. And Hynek came up with the explanation for that one lone sighting, possibly swamp gas, marsh gas. Well, that's exactly what the press latched onto. That here was the consultant, the scientific consultant, the Project Blue Book, that was explaining away all the Michigan sightings at that time as being simply swamp gas. And it was not intended as far as, and to the time he died, he was constantly reminding people it only was in reference to one lone sighting at that time. And they never allowed him to live it down.
Wow.
That colleagues, even in the field, swamp gas there. And I, to this day, even regards to Roswell, someone will jokingly bring up, well, it was just swamp gas. And I'm sorry, there's more to the story. And that the other sightings, for example, quickly, there was an Air Force officer who was a sighting, who was a witness at that time. And the Air Force covered up the fact that they had a major witness who saw something truly extraordinary, along with the students at the university and the police who were involved. So this was just one more example of just how legitimate these sightings were. Well, Alan went and talked to this Air Force officer. He got it all on tape. It was a wonderful close encounter. Air Force completely covered it up. Blue Book would not even allow Alan to talk about it publicly, that there were legitimate sightings at that time. They too played up the swamp gas.
Oh.
And that point about, you know, being sort of misrepresented in the press, you know, my father was a professor and he was used to being able to hold the floor for as long as he wanted to make a point. And being on TV, although he was comfortable in front of the camera, the UFO field is not something that really reduces easily to sound bites. So, you know, people try to score points, like Carl Sagan would try to score points in debates. And this was something my father felt he was not really on even footing, because you can't really sum up the nuances of one of the most vexing questions ever to face mankind in a 10-minute segment between commercials.
Yeah. You brought up Sagan and the famous debates between Carl Sagan and your father. And your father was pretty nervous going into that situation for that very fact that you just described, Paul, that it's more than just a soundbite. It's more than just a paper. It's more than just an exchange of ideas at a debate situation. And Dr. Hynek presented a paper for his opening statement. And I'll never forget how Sagan just comes walking out and takes the microphone from the podium and then steps in front of it and leans on the front of it with one elbow, and he starts to do shtick. He starts to put on his show. And it truly affected Alan Hynek in the sense that for years thereafter, we would be in the field together. We would be working on something. And if he said it once, he said it a dozen times, where Alan would say to me, or say to the other researchers or investigators with us, he would go, "Well, what will Carl say? What will Carl say?" So it was a shadow I wish he didn't acknowledge, but nonetheless, it was there. And it was all because of that debate that he felt that there from thereafter that he had to prove something to Carl Sagan. And as far as I'm concerned, he didn't have to prove anything.
Yeah.
He already had demonstrated that there was a legitimate phenomenon. And Sagan was honestly in the hip pocket of the powers that be in Washington. He was getting grants and public and funding as far as other projects. And at the time, Alan Hynek was not. So it's night and day.
I mean, there were papers by Sagan that, you know, early papers in the 60s that, you know, showed that he really thought there was something more going on.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But they bought him off. They bought him off. And clearly the difference is Carl Sagan had a price, and they met it, and he accepted it, and was, as I said, he worked for them thereafter. Alan Hynek did not.
Wow. I want to say this. We're going to start taking phone calls now. So anyone on YouTube, you can see the number up there. If you're over at KGRA Radio, that number is 855-472-5483. So we are taking calls, and Bill, who does a wonderful job, is screening the calls. So the lines are open, and we are ready to take your calls. I want to talk to you, Paul, about Father Gill, because first of all, I love that case. Mm-hmm. I think that was 1959 or something like when that happened. But he seemed like such an authentic guy. What was he like in person?
Yeah, he came to our house for dinner, I think in the mid-70s. And you know, he was in Papua New Guinea as an Anglican missionary, and he came for an ecumenical religious conference in Chicago. And my father had known him for years, and he came to our house for dinner. And one of the things my father would do is not, I don't say interrogate, but question or talk to a witness of, or an experiencer, as we say these days, of an encounter over the course of years. And try to see if the story got embellished or changed, et cetera.
Wow.
One of the things he thought about Father Gill was that he was remarkably consistent over the years with his retelling of the incident. And I was impressed because Father Gill was not looking to profit from his experience, was not overly eager to talk about it, but if you're somebody like that and you come to the Hynek house and you're fed, the kind of quid pro quo is you're really going to have to talk about the sighting you had. So he knew the deal. So he starts talking about it. And, you know, I've met many people in the UFO field, many experiencers, and I could see my father, how he was asking him questions from maybe a slightly different angle than he had before. And what jumped out to me about Father Gill was – He was extraordinarily intelligent. He was very comfortable in his skin. He was just sort of matter-of-factly relating something so out of this world, perhaps literally. And, you know, even at the time of the sighting, he's taking notes. He's taking contemporaneous notes. He's like the perfect witness.
Wow.
And I was struck by how intelligent, how calm, how matter-of-fact he was. There was just nothing about him to impeach him as a witness. And, of course, there were hundreds of other witnesses as well. And that was a case that my father loved because it didn't have some of the more salacious aspects that would make it a little bit uncomfortable for him to talk about at the time, and yet had so much corroboration and such a fantastic witness.
Right. Yeah, that just we actually told the story last week, or a little bit of it, when it happened. You know, this object came, and it was more than one night, I do believe. But they were standing on top of the craft, and they actually interacted, and they brought the torches out, the flashlight out, and the craft itself actually mimicked the movement of the flashlight, which is quite amazing.
Yeah, one of the few monkey see, monkey do cases in ufology.
Yeah, yeah. Paul, who are some of the other people that came to dinner there? That sounded like that would be such a place to go to dinner.
And yes, my mom did make good lasagna and casserole. Lots of people. Calvin Parker.
Calvin, actually, I know you're friends and keep in touch with Calvin all the time.
I told him I was going to talk trash about him during the broadcast today.
That's good.
Travis Walton. And many others. And, you know, people like Don and people from the center. And also just regular astronomers who had either a passing or no interest in ufology. But, you know, my father was a scientist, not a UFO guy. And so he wanted our family to be sort of inculcated in the overall scientific method and the sort of wonders of science and the many wonderful questions there are to ask about the world. So it was a real smorgasbord of all kinds of folks. I remember the comedian Dick Gregory, and just all sorts of people. One of my favorite dinners, so to speak, was a series of meals for 2 weeks. My younger brother Ross and my mom and dad and I went on an eclipse cruise in 1973 off the coast of West Africa. And for 2 weeks, our family and one other family shared all of our meals together. And that was Neil Armstrong and his family.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. So I'm an 11-year-old kid, son of an astronomer, 4 years after the moon launch, spending 2 weeks with Neil Armstrong and his family.
That's right.
It was just incredible. And as I later found out, there's an article published based on a letter my father wrote to Jenny Zeidman in The Sun from the UK last year or the year before that said there was Neil Armstrong who requested that it be our family that sit next to his family. And of course, he had his pick of the litter, right? So either he's a fan of my father's mainstream astronomical career, or he had some interest in UFOs.
How about that?
Which I can also verify in that when your father was putting pressure on Len Stringfield on his crash retrieval cases that he was accumulating.
Right.
And not revealing his sources. And your father was trying to leverage different approaches. Now, how and who should I bring in as a third party that with enough notoriety, enough respectability, not in ufology necessarily, but within the country as a whole, within the world for that matter. And when he finally approached Len and said, well, the third party that would work with us on crash retrieval cases was none other than Neil Armstrong. Mm-hmm.
Holy wow. Hey, we have a call. We have a couple calls here. So I'm going to bring in our first caller, and that is Andy. He's calling from Connecticut. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Hey, my question is for either guest, but did Mr. Hynek have a favorite theory on where he thought the UFOs might originate from, or was he just, did he remain open-minded his entire life? And good show, guys. I'll take your question off there.
I'll take that. And I think what you mentioned about open-minded is very important. My father felt it's important to keep your mind open when you're confronted by what may seem to be a new phenomena. And that new phenomena may run counter to your beliefs, counter to the grant you just received, but you don't know. And then equally important to the point that you're making, once you maybe determine that there is something there, that you don't rush to grab the best available answer and shove it into that slot, because it may be much more complex. You know, my father and Jacques Vallée and Don and others came to the conclusion largely that a garden variety nuts and bolts extraterrestrial origin was perhaps part of the phenomena, but didn't seem to explain and encompass all the aspects of the phenomena. You know, my father called the book, his first book on the subject, the UFO experience, not the UFO sighting, because there are lots of elements that go well beyond just seeing some craft in the sky. And so one of the ideas he entertained is that it could well be some portion extraterrestrial travel, but there are problems with that. And so not only how would they get here, but why would they come here? Why would they be interested when we are less than a speck of cosmic dust? So things even perhaps more exotic, like interdimensional travel and things like that, he started entertaining, because that would at least explain how they got here if they're sort of here adjacent, and why they would care about us.
See, Paul, you mentioned that your father, as an astrophysicist, as an astronomer, that the greatest dilemma that he faced in all this was the vast distances of space. He just had a very difficult time accepting space travel from point A to point B. And Paul would remember that as he would put on a demonstration, and he would use a single playing card.
Yeah.
Not the width, but the thickness of the playing card, equaling the distance from the Earth to the Moon. And then he would pose the question, how many playing cards to equal the distance from the Earth to our nearest star system, Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away? Nobody ever came close.
Yeah.
But he was always very, you know, very dignified, very proud to say, well, 19 miles of playing cards.
How about that?
Just comprehend that. Well, but just imagine him as an astronomer trying to grasp as far as that distance. But yet the last time I, and Paul is absolutely correct, last time I had dinner with his father, and I will never forget his, you know, pounding his fist on the table and going, Don, it's smacking more and more of nuts and bolts. But nonetheless, he also then would entertain, he would use the example of the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. And all you see is the smile after it disappears. And that was the same thing with the UFO phenomenon. That you would see it, now you see it, now you don't. Where does it go? Witnesses at point A see it moving to point B, and yet the people at point B don't see it approach. They do not see it arrive. Where did it go? So that's the greatest mystery in all this, that we're dealing with something that is beyond just nuts and bolts, that it clearly is something that is able to literally appear like magic out of nowhere. And Alan Hynek accepted that 100%.
Yeah, and you know, he was very comfortable describing the sort of body of cases and conclusions that you could make from the cases, but a little bit less comfortable talking about the origins, because he didn't really know. I mean, it's a very difficult field. And there's always like this tantalizing answer right around the corner. So to state where they come from or who they are, that's very difficult. But, you know, he just wanted to keep his mind open about other possibilities besides the knee-jerk extraterrestrial default hypothesis.
Right. I think that was a smart move. We have another caller. We have Ron calling from Minnesota. Ron, welcome to the show.
Hi, Martin, and great show tonight. Thank you for your guest, Don and Paul. And I had a question for all three of you, actually, but you guys can take turns and answer the question to the best of your thinking about what I have. Do you think, looking at it from a scientific point of view, the UFO phenomenon, do you think that it is a threatening presence, or are you at peace when you see a sighting, or when you realize, hey, that's not an airplane? Are you afraid, or are you more curious about what you see?
Anyone want to take that?
I'll say that I'm not afraid. My sister Roxanne has admonished me not to go on a craft if I have the chance, and of course I will. My only fear might be radiation or some kind of a chemistry problem. But my feeling is, if we're being visited by another culture, either from another dimension and or another star system, their technology is so much more advanced than ours. It's almost like the singularity that we cannot even comprehend it. So if they were here for malevolent purposes, we wouldn't know it. Okay, maybe they're here to interbreed and puppet master us. I find that a little bit convoluted. Well, I think if we're being visited by different species who had bad intent, they were bad cosmic actors, I think we would know.
Yeah.
And that's a point often made. If we even go back to the summer of 47, the very, you know, modern age of ufology, as we would call it, that where was the first atomic bomb detonated? Well, New Mexico. Where was the first atomic bomb squadron headquartered? Roswell, New Mexico. You had all the testing of the captured German V-2 rockets at White Sands. You had ongoing atomic research at Los Alamos in New Mexico. And according to Project Blue Book, where were there more UFO sightings than anywhere else in the world at that time but New Mexico? So it was as though the phenomenon was first checking out our military potential to see if we had a bigger stick than they did. And after they realized we weren't a threat to them, though it still appears it's very hands-off, very indifferent. There clearly hasn't been a landing on the White House front lawn, because what is our typical reaction? We shoot first and ask questions later.
Yeah.
So maybe in their vast knowledge beyond our own, they realize that the best way to handle us is not to handle us. You know, hands off, keep it. And as the old, Charles Fort, you know, a suggestion that we may be the universal insane asylum, that all the crazies are dumped here, and we're like the galactic zoo. So they know better than to get, you know, too close. We might be contagious.
Well, great answer. Thank you very much. And Martin, what about you?
Well, I don't think, I think if they were malevolent, we would know by now, like was said earlier. But I don't want to say that I don't know anything. That's the best way I can say it. You know, some people have said to me, I've heard people say, well, you know, what if they're not doing anything because we're going to be a harvest? Well, which is pretty gruesome. But I would say to that, what are they waiting for? There's plenty of billions of people to feed on if they want to do that. So I don't know. I have no idea what's going on, where they're from. And, you know, like Don mentioned earlier, the star travel, how, you know, the nearest star, I mentioned it last week, an astronomer said, you know, if the Earth was the size of a ball and a ballpoint pen, the nearest star would be out in California if the ballpoint pen was in Washington, D.C. So, you know, that to give the scale of distance is just, it's so hard to try to figure it out how they get here. They may have something they know about physics if they are traveling through the stars. They may know something about physics that we haven't discovered yet. It's awful
Martin,
hard to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. The lines are open, everyone. Oh, we have another one just came in. Go ahead. Who is talking? Was it you, John? Did you say something?
Paul was commenting.
Oh,
yeah. Go ahead. One more point to make about that, Martin. You know, this notion of evil aliens is kind of on par with a singularity where artificial intelligence takes over the world. And frankly, I'm less concerned about evil aliens and artificial intelligence than I am about garden variety human stupidity. Because especially in the year 2020, we've got problems of our own making here. And I'm not so concerned with what others may do to us, but our own ability to survive on this planet.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. Absolutely. Okay, we have a couple of calls here still. We have, looks like Jonna. Jonna, is it? Texas, how do you pronounce your name?
Yeah.
Hi. Hi there.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. You have a question for one of our guests?
Yes, I was wondering from Paul Hynek if he ever got to see the Betz ball or actually put his hands on it.
I can answer that with a firm maybe. I did a presentation at an AlienCon, which is a lovely atmosphere, and somebody came up to me afterwards who was affiliated with the Betz family and said, did you ever have the Betz sphere? Did you ever see that? And I remembered when I was a teenager, we had this funky silver ball, like, I don't know if you can see my hands, about like that diameter, that we would kick around on the floor in the basement. And the story was that it was some kind of industrial ball bearing or something. But it seemed kind of strange to me. And I never really got it. My father brought it home one day. And later I thought, well, if my father was hiding something, it's kind of like that Edgar Allan Poe story. You put it out in plain sight. Give it to your long-haired teenage kids who are just going to play with it in the basement. No one will ever think to look for something down there. I don't know what happened to that sphere. And I really don't know if it was the Betz sphere. I tend to doubt it, but that's all I have to give you on that.
Oh.
Okay. Fair enough.
Maybe. Oh.
Maybe. I love it. All right. Hey, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
All right. We do have, looks like Ray. It could be the Ray. All Ray right. Stanford, possibly, from hey. Maryland.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. What did you say?
Is this Ray Stanford?
Yes. Yes.
Ray, if you have your computer volume on for the show, you're going to have to mute it. I've heard some feedback there.
Hey, can I call back? That took up about my phone has a problem. It cuts off after 10 minutes. Vonage has got a problem they're trying to correct. And can I call back so that I have
a little bit? You bet.
Two things.
Okay, no problem.
Really enjoy. Can I call right back?
Let's call her back. Yeah. And Ray was not joking about that 10-minute thing. I talked to him a day or two ago, and his phone, every 10 minutes, exactly on the second, hangs up. It's a very strange he has no idea why that's happening. But it was right to the second. It's pretty scary. He's calling back now. I'm going to give him a minute.
Par for the field, yeah.
Yeah, someone's listening. It's possible.
Yeah, we've got a caller who can only call for 10 minutes and a host who we can't see.
Yes.
Welcome to UFOs.
Now, wait a minute. I want to show you something. Look at what happened.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Nope, just like that.
Yeah. Finally, the light came over the right way. Okay, I'm going to bring Ray back on the air. Ray, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, doing fine. Hi.
Hi.
The volume seems a little low. I'm going to turn it up here. Hold on just a moment.
This is the Ray Stanford that wrote the Socorro book.
Yes.
Right. Hey, I just thought it would be nice to call in and add a couple of little brief stories, a little mirth that Paul might enjoy about his dad.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, he visited us both in Phoenix and San Antonio, and then finally when I moved to Austin all those years and visiting our laboratory down there. And one time he came in the airport, and I wanted to help him carry his luggage. He had looked like heavy luggage and a briefcase. And so I grabbed the luggage And he said, "Oh, Ray, don't bother with that. Just take the briefcase." So I grabbed the briefcase, and my gosh, it felt like it weighed 40 pounds. Not really, but it felt that way. And I said, do you have a nickel iron meteorite in here? And he said, "No." I said, "What in the world is in here then?" He said, "Well, open it up." And I opened it up, and there I beheld an incredibly beautiful, expensive-looking cut glass container full of whiskey. And I said, "Alan, you never impressed me as being much of a drinker." And he said, "Well, you got to understand, I'm heading to a meeting with pilots to try to get them to talk about their sightings."
Pilots, yeah. Just who you want to drink. Yeah.
And he would do that. He would.
Yeah.
Well, especially let me. Officers, you're trying to loosen their.
A little bit different, but Paul had mentioned that his dad was at times a bit absent-minded, and I have a wonderful story to tell about that. In front of me is a letter of July 6, 1976, which he had written to give me something to use in promoting the Socorro book. And of course, he and I were there together at the site in Socorro in 1964. And in there, he says... it says Stanford has transformed the case from a one-witness matter to a multi-witness case and thus has accomplished what the Air Force failed to do. Well, here's the funny component of that. So he was visiting Austin, and we were riding from our offices out to our lab site for him to see the latest installment of equipment. And he said, "Ray," he said, "you know," he said, "how did you come up with those two witnesses, Paul Kais and Larry Kratzer, in your book?" He said, "you know, the Air Force tried to find additional witnesses." And where did you come up with that? And I said, "Alan, are you sure you want to know?" And he said, "Yes, I want to know." And I said, "Okay, the truth of the matter is that information came out of a corrugated box in your attic in your home."
Wow. And
he said, "Wait a minute. How is that possible?" I said, "Well, you know, the UFO researcher who studies occupant cases in New York, I was visiting Alan, and he said, 'Look, you can go up in the attic. There's corrugated boxes up there full of all kinds of articles and things you might find interesting in this context.' He said, 'I was up there and I found this, and I thought of you that you were writing a book on Socorro, and I thought you ought to know about it.' Well, the irony of this all is that actually Alan had, offered, I think it was $150, maybe it wasn't, but if somebody could find him another witness to the Socorro case. And so someone had sent him this article from the Dubuque paper with Paul Kais and Larry Kratzer's photographs. And they had told that they were witnesses. And so
Sorry, Ray. We were getting some feedback. I don't know what was going on there with the phone. He's got some weird phone stuff going on, but we have one more caller and great stories, huh? One more caller. We have Chris calling from Houston. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi. I have a question about a couple of topics that I'm wondering if Dr. Hynek spoke about, if it was concerned about with any group, with the dinner table group or more scientific group. Two topics. One is about, in terms of the distance of travel. You mentioned interstellar. You mentioned, you know, maybe nuts and bolts, other kinds of things. But does anybody have, was there consideration or talk about the possibility, did he have views about the possibility of closer travel, like from other planets in our system, and the feasibility of the idea that there might be an advanced people out there running around in our near space that we wouldn't know about? The second one, and I'll take it off the air, but the second topic is relative to the nuclear connection, the atomic bomb connection with the beginning of the major sightings and the reports of overflights of facilities after that. Was there concern, and you mentioned the tendency, you know, we assume the tendency of the military to shoot first and ask questions later. which didn't happen on the Nimitz, of course. The question is, did the topic of the danger of military response come up? Was there concern about what might happen, or any scenarios laid out or played out about what might happen if we were hostile to them? So that's, I'll take it off the air.
Thank you. Anyone want to take that?
Yeah. Well, in regards to the phenomenon being much closer than dealing with the vast distances of space, yes, we would talk about even just like a mothership, like a Starship Enterprise that happened to be within our solar system. We would talk at times even the discussion of the hollow Earth, which would be immediately discounted. But nonetheless, we would talk about the phenomenon setting up shop here, that there could be, you know, bases underground, there could be, you know, domed bases under the oceans, that type of thing. And Dr. Hynek always came back to the fact that we have just too many sightings, too many. I mean, every day there are reports coming in. And he would say, I would be much more comfortable if we would have one good sighting a year, which would be much more, you know, symbolic of something traveling such great distances, as opposed to something that is able to pop in and out, as I used that phrase earlier, at will, suggesting that it's something around us, something here, possibly from another dimension, another a parallel universe, that type of thing. And so, again, much to Dr. J. Allen Hynek's credit, that he was open and willing to entertain every possible solution to the UFO mystery.
Wow. Very interesting. We have to close the show in just 2 minutes, but I mean, I can continue a little bit longer. We're done with calls, but I think we can pretty much wrap this up. We just have like a minute and a half, actually. So Don, I have to apologize to you. We never really got to talk about your book.
Oh, not at all. This was wonderful, especially, and I hope I can do this again with Paul, because it just a rush of memories. I mean, we could, between the two of us, just some of the anecdotal stories, you know, when I had the good fortune of being on a radio program with Alan one time, and then the late Bud Hopkins, what happened when Alan fell asleep one time during the middle of a radio interview, live in studio, that type of thing. So we need to do this again, just because I truly enjoyed this, and especially doing it with Paul.
Yeah, but, excellent.
Don, tell us the name of the book.
Oh, the new book is, I have to look.
Thank you, Paul.
There have been so many. Roswell, the Ultimate Cold Case Closed. So in other words, our day in court. We present our opening arguments as to why we are convinced that Roswell indeed did happen. And then we present our evidentiary, and then our closing arguments, our eyewitness, you know, testimonies, all supportive of that very conviction. And so this will be our last book as far as demonstrating what we believe is the granddaddy of all UFO cases, Roswell.
All right. Well, for right now, I'm just going to say goodbye to everyone over at KGRA Radio, and we will be back next week with Linda Zimmerman. So goodbye over there. We're going to continue just a couple more minutes because I don't want to just shut you off. All right. So, Paul, I just wanted to tell you, thank you so much. It's always been a pleasure. And I love your sense of humor. You have
his father's sense of humor.
He inherited it. It was so fun. So much fun to hang out with you in Phoenix with Calvin Parker and a few other people. Do you remember that woman that was stalking us? Do you remember that woman? She was kind of scary.
Yeah, without shoes.
That's the one. Yeah. Did she show up at your house?
I married her, so please tread carefully on that.
Yes, that's true. That's true. All right. Well, hey, thanks. I really, really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun tonight. Thank you so much. And,
pleasure
I would love to do this again.
Pleasure.
And say hi to Calvin for me when you talk to him, Paul.
Well, I talked to him as well, so I know.
Oh, you do? Yeah. So, what a great guy. Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to get it.
No, not a great guy. Not a great guy at all.
I've said
I was going to trash him.
Yeah, I've said a few times on this show that I'm trying to get Calvin and the new witnesses that came forward all together on the show to talk about that. You know, in a case that old, isn't that amazing? You could still get new witnesses that feel comfortable enough to come forward.
That case is kind of like a Tesla. It gets more valuable over time.
Right.
And more solid. And again, much credit to Calvin for standing, you know, tall as far as now by himself. And
yeah,
he's a good man.
He is. And, you know, he's a very intelligent man and he's done very well in life. He's done a lot of things. He's what a go-getter that guy is.
And we hope his health holds out because we know he's got some major health issues at the moment. So
right, right. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Good night. Good night. Whoops. I didn't mean to cut him off again, but I did. Anyway, thank you, everyone, for listening. And don't forget to come back next week with Linda Zimmerman. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. And do remember to keep your eyes open.